Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We are glad to have you with us today. On our program, new stem cell research coming out of Michigan suggests there may be a way to ease the symptoms for patients who suffer from ALS, commonly known as Lou Gehrig disease. We talk with the neurologist leading the nation's first clinical trial of stem cell injections in patients with a deadly degenerative disease. But first, we continue our look at the financial challenges that face Michigan schools. The litany of districts in serious money trouble is long and growing longer. Buena Vista, Benton Harbor, Detroit, Pontiac, Albion, and now we hear today Hazel Park schools are broke, according to the superintendent, who blames an unexpected drop in student enrollment. Some 50 public school districts across our state are facing deep deficits. Buena Vista, of course, closed down for 2 weeks while it scrambled to find enough money to keep things running. Other districts have applied layoffs and program cuts. Desperate times call for desperate measures, and some say Michigan has too many school districts, and consolidating some of those districts is a prudent choice. Last year, the state encouraged Ypsilanti and nearby Willow Run schools to consolidate. After tough decisions, that consolidation will happen July 1st. Joining me in the studio now is the person who's been guiding the consolidation. Scott Menzel is superintendent of the Washtenaw Intermediate School District, and as of July 1st, he will also be the superintendent of the new unified district, which will be known as Ypsilanti Community Schools. Scott, what is it like for you watching all these cracks developing and widening in other districts while you're busy consolidating Willow Run and Ypsilanti?
Well, it's a concern. As you know, public education is of critical importance to the future of our state. And so as we see more and more districts struggling, going underwater, unable to keep the programs that kids need to be successful in place, that's a concern. It was our concern back in 2011 when the board presidents from both Ypsilanti and Willow Run approached WISD and asked us to facilitate a conversation between the two districts. At that time, they were both deficit districts. Willow Run had been in deficit for a longer period of time than Ypsilanti. Ypsilanti's deficit was a bit larger in terms of the dollar amount, but both were struggling financially. They were losing students on a regular basis, a dramatic decline in student enrollment, and academically they were both struggling. And so the board presidents recognized something needed to be done, and at first the thought was just that they would share more services between the two districts. And being side by side, both with Ypsilanti mailing addresses, it made some sense to collaborate. What we found in the course of our year of facilitating that conversation is that it wouldn't go far enough. Any of the shared service concepts that we talked about were just tinkering at the margins, and they really, none of those were getting at the core academic issues. If we're going to change the trajectory for young kids in urban environments, we have to do some things differently. It was a broken system academically and broken financially. And so as we got to the end of that first year, we realized that something different needed to happen. We needed to move from a conversation about things that were tinkering at the margin to really restructuring the entire system.
So basically hitting the reset button.
It was hitting the reset button. And so we moved the conversation to, if we're going to hit the reset button, what would that look like? And how do we move forward on the conversation of consolidation with communities that have long histories? Ypsilanti's been in existence for 164 years. Willow Run emerged out of the growth of the bomber plant. Mm-hmm. They've got long and distinguished histories in different ways and sometimes rivalries in between the two. And so we knew that it was going to be a complicated conversation. But at the same time, it was really the only alternative to the appointment of an emergency manager. Given the length of the time that Willow Run was in deficit and given the size of the Ypsilanti deficit, it was clear that there was no way to get out of the hole. They're in what we'll call the death spiral. If you have the combination of being deficit and declining enrollment, any of the cuts that you make further reduce what you're able to offer students. That drives more parents away. So now less students, less ability to provide high-quality educational experiences. Exact opposite of what we needed for our students.
So you had to reverse the death spiral.
We had to, and the only way to do that was consolidation. And fortunately, in the school aid budget last year, $10 million was set aside to support consolidation. So we had one piece of incentive on the financial side to say the districts that consolidate have this potential for a fair share of $10 million, whatever that was going to be. Didn't know how much, and we didn't oversell how much we thought that we would receive from that $10 million, but we knew that was approved in the school aid budget. We also had support from the state superintendent of instruction, because as you look at the deficit, the combined deficit between the two districts, about $13 million. If we had to repay that in 2 or 3 years, we'd still be in the same position, right?
Right.
We need an extended repayment period so that if you take $1 million off the top each year and extend that out over 15 years, that's a reasonable repayment period. Poor decisions were made by both districts, and in some cases, when they were making progress towards deficit elimination, cut in student foundation grant eroded the progress they made. So Willow Run was getting close. They were on an upward swing in terms of eliminating
that
deficit.
Pushed back down.
$470 loss per pupil. And right back in that same deficit is where they found themselves. So those are the dynamics that we were facing. Mm. But the community itself, I mean, if you here's a telling fact. 2,600 students in the 2011 and 12 school year, school of choice to a charter or another public school, 2,600 that lived within the boundaries of those two districts, $19 million walked out the door to some other educational alternative. The imperative was to actually change the system.
You got to keep them because you got to offer a product.
Right.
It's good.
So the opportunity that was presented to the community with the consolidation vote was to truly hit the reset button, to reconceptualize the educational experience, not just a conventional K-12 system. One of the things that we heard often during the campaign was, are you just going to create a larger mess? You know, you've got two deficit districts. They're financially bankrupt, academically struggling. Combining them, how does that do anything but create a larger mess?
It's a good question.
But in fact, we have the opportunity to build from the ground up, and not just a K-12 system, but a cradle-to-career system, focusing on the needs of children and families from birth through kindergarten entry. We know that those first few years of life are the most important developmentally. If you're going to enter kindergarten ready to succeed, you can't ignore what happens before they get into kindergarten. And then as they're moving through the system, creating opportunities to support them in their environment and ultimately ensure that every student who graduates from Ypsilanti Community Schools has an opportunity to earn college credit or a career credential.
So we know what the goal is. So can I ask you this? What were the toughest decisions and the most emotion-charged decisions that have had to be made? I got to imagine it starts with teachers and merging staffs.
Well, that's a big part of it. You know, so as you have to, I mean, the financial realities are such that we still have to contract.
Right.
Consolidation does mean that we're going to have fewer staff, that we're going to have less buildings open. That is a difficult conversation.
Can you give us a number? How many teachers? How many buildings?
Well, I can tell you that of the current staff, 171 were offered or told they will be offered positions in the new district.
Current staff of?
Of Ypsilanti Willow Run.
How many is the current staff?
There are 258 applications.
All right.
So 106. So some people chose to retire or not apply, but there were 258 applications.
Okay.
Of those, 171 were given letters, yes, you met the criteria, and there'll be a position for you in the fall.
Okay.
Another 32 were given maybe letters that indicated they met the criteria, but until we know what the enrollment is, we can't make a commitment.
All right.
And then 55 were given no letters.
All right.
And not every no is a person who's not a high-quality teacher. We had an extraordinarily compressed timeline. When you're interviewing 258 teachers and you're moving through that process quickly, you might catch a teacher on a bad day, or they may not put their best foot forward in the application material that they submitted because they haven't applied for 20 years anywhere. So we understand some of those things, and we'll encourage them as positions become available to reapply. And that's really challenging because we want to recognize and reward the hard work of teachers. At the same time, we want to hire people who have and share the vision of Ypsilanti Community Schools.
And this reset vision.
Absolutely.
What about buildings? You've had to close buildings, and people have, as you alluded to, strong emotional ties to whatever that school is that their family's known. So how many have you closed, and how have you overcome parental worries?
Willow Run had walked down this road over the course of the last few years and had reconfigured their district and closed facilities already, which kind of helps in the process. And they did it through ongoing series of community meetings where they really engaged the community so that by the time they closed those facilities, you didn't hear a lot of community uproar. They understood the nature of the financial challenges and why the reconfiguration was necessary. Mm. Ypsilanti has closed a few facilities. They closed East Middle School. They closed Chapel Elementary. Those were more contentious decisions. And if you look at Ypsi's longer past, there have been other facilities that have closed as well. Where we're at this point is that a decision has been made to close the middle school in Ypsilanti will use the complex in Willow Run for middle school programming, largely because that's the newer facility. It was constructed in 2004. It's a great space for middle school age students. And so that was not a difficult decision. There are a couple of other facilities that are not being used primarily for K-12 education. They've got other programs in them. Mm. We're likely to bring those down to complete closure so that we don't incur the expense there and move the programs that are operating out of those into available space either in the high school or other spaces between the two districts.
Well, you're in the home stretch, busily putting things together for that July 1st deadline and then kids coming in September. And we want to make sure we touch base with you and have you in to talk about that. But in our last minute or so, what can you tell to the parents, talk to the parents and people listening from these other districts in trouble and having to face some hard choices?
So when the question was put in front of the voters in Ypsilanti and Willow Run to consolidate, 61% in both communities said yes. They said yes because they recognized it was the only way for them to preserve a sense of local control of their public education system. It was inevitable that an emergency manager would be appointed to take over the affairs. And the choice was, do we want to have a say about how our kids are educated and in recreating this vision of public education in Ypsilanti, or do we want someone else to come in and do it unilaterally? To me, that choice is pretty clear. And the hope for Ypsilanti Community Schools is that we'll be successful in creating the cradle-to-career education system and that the students ultimately will be the beneficiaries of this vision.
Scott Menzel is the superintendent of the Washtenaw Intermediate School District, and come July 1st, he will be the superintendent of the new unified district, Ypsilanti Community Schools. So we will look forward to hearing more from you as this all comes together and the execution of the plan begins and you actually see those students in the new district. Thanks for speaking with us today, Scott.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
There is no shortage of articles, quotes, and news stories that tell us what politicians and business titans and other leaders think of Michigan and its future. But all too often, their view is from 35,000 feet up. How about the view from the ground, from tomorrow's leaders, from college students? That's the idea behind a website launched by business journalism students at Central Michigan University. It's called Reinventing Michigan, The Rebirth of Michigan, Hopeful Solutions for Moving Forward. These students are being guided in all of this by their professor, Mickey Maynard, who, among other credits, was the Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She joins us in the studio along with one of her students, Austin Stowe of South Lyon. Austin's a junior at CMU. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Sue.
Yeah, thanks.
And welcome back, Mickey, as you wear your teacher hat. What was the goal in creating the Reinventing Michigan website? What did you want the students to get out of it?
Well, I had the opportunity when I was a visiting professor at the University of Nevada, Reno, to work on a site called Reinventing Reno. Reno has a lot of the same problems as Detroit. It has one major industry, casinos, which is kind of dwindling. And there's a lot of talk out there, you know, we don't want to be Detroit. We want to reinvent ourselves. We only had a week to do that. Here we had the whole semester. And we were lucky that we have students everywhere from Upper Michigan down to the Detroit area, from Grand Rapids across to the Thumb. And so we got a much broader perspective from, let's just say, a younger audience than you normally hear about.
And you could go broad. You could go to the whole state as opposed to one, like to Detroit only.
Exactly. And the nice thing about this was that there was time to do multimedia. We have video. We have a lot of photo slideshows. Austin, who you'll hear from, went out with his tape recorder and got some great audio from the folks that he talked to in Detroit.
What was their task when the students were told, all right, we're doing this Reinventing Michigan website? What was the task?
I wanted to find stories that no one else was telling. I wanted to get away from the reports, from the projections, and go to towns like Greenville and up to St. Helen and to Detroit and to the suburbs of Detroit, Lansing, and basically say, okay, what are you seeing that is happening in Michigan? Stories of hope, but also stories of reality, because it isn't all good news, and that's a sign that we have to work harder.
That is very, very challenging. Certainly different, Austin, than turning some paper in and to the professor and then calling it a day and moving on to the next
thing. Totally different, yeah.
All right. So, Austin, you wrote a very long and detailed piece exploring the different communities that you discovered made up the city of Detroit and how you saw them building their brands. Give us a sense of what you found.
All right. So I went to Corktown, I went to Midtown, I went to Eastern Market, and I went to Mexican Town. And I just wanted to get like a different story, because there's always these stories coming out about Detroit about just it being like degraded, being like all torn down, nothing happening there. But at the same time, I wanted to capture the different vibes, the different flavors going on in every single like area in Detroit. So that was my main goal when writing my story.
Give me a sense then of what you found with those four areas and what the brand is and what the vibe was like.
All right, so Mexicantown, I guess it's just a Latin flavor. Like there's just the restaurants kind of make up that area. Eastern Market, obviously you have the new markets all renovated and stuff. It got renovated in 2008. And that place is just always, there's always people around there. You got Midtown, and I actually went to Avalon International Breads and interviewed the owner there. Because of their business, they ended up getting a bunch of new businesses opening whenever they had their anniversary. And then from Corktown, I ended up interviewing Phil Cooley from Slow's Barbecue. Mm-hmm. And he just provided a bunch of information on how Corktown's, they have all the hipster community coming in, and it's just a new, like, hip, young person kind of place there. So.
Yeah, that it is. Yeah. That it is. And then I guess the next question that might be interesting, and I'd love your view now that you've been in the city and talked to people, what about the larger pieces of the city that are more neighborhoods? Some of them are in better shape than the others. Because what we're hearing in these neighborhoods are kind of the younger, hipper, maybe whiter new residents coming in. What are your thoughts about how to integrate that into the more established, older neighborhoods so you don't wind up with two Detroits, one maybe young, hip, and more white, and one more African-American and perhaps more in a poverty zone? There's an interesting challenge that you've opened with your piece.
Yeah. Like you said, I mean, it's all about integrating. Like, when I talked to Phil Cooley, he was talking about how there's those empty spaces in between the different communities. You have a community, and then you have like an area of poverty where there's just absolutely nothing. And then you have the next community. You got to fill in that space that there's nothing in to like bring both of the communities together. So.
Got them thinking.
Well, one place that Austin writes about and looks at is Eastern Market, which is a terrific melting pot for the rest of the city. You see everybody of every ethnic background, white, black, Middle Eastern, Asian, Latino. You know, food is a great community force.
It is.
Exactly. And so Eastern Market is a wonderful example of, you know, what Detroit could be. And it isn't an expensive, chic, hip place.
Exactly.
Which goes to show that if you've got something that will bring people all together, unified around a concept, they'll come. And I love that part of your story because it just showed, you know, we're not going to all be riding our bikes and you know, drinking microbrews. We're going to be going and looking for vegetables.
Yeah, that was, like you said, that was definitely the most integrated place when it came to everybody coming together there. It was just the food.
What are some of the other stories that students turned up, Vicki, that went throughout Michigan that particularly that maybe really caught your eye and made you go, wow, good digging?
Well, everybody did a terrific job. But one of the stories that really resonated with me is the story of the Charlton Heston Academy. And if you look at our website, it leads the website. There's a wonderful video. Matt Varsak, who is from St. Helen, it's between Houghton Lake and West Branch. 3,000 population. They lost their elementary school. All those little kids were going to have to ride the bus 15 miles. And the parents and a nonprofit group got together, went to Lansing, convinced Lake Superior State to back them, because to open a charter, you have to have someone's backing
all
to
right.
do so. It opened last fall. It's, I believe, pre-K through 8. They've already got plans to make it into a full pre-K through high school, and it's the largest employer in St. Helens. We've got some data-driven journalism about the fact that, you know, we talk about the improvements that have happened in Michigan, but Kate Barnes went back and looked at data with help from Don Grimes at the University of Michigan and found that we aren't back to where we were in 2007 and before the recession started. We have quite a ways to go. And then Ben Raven, one of our students, is from Greenville, Michigan, which is where the Electrolux factory closed. And then United Solar, which was supposed to replace the Electrolux factory, closed. And he talked about what it's like to be from Greenville and then see all of this crumble. And he actually talked to Jennifer Granholm, who said that she thinks about Greenville every night. It was interesting to get the perspective of a former governor into our package.
What did you get, Mickey, as far as what you read from your students, as far as their vision for the future of Michigan? What did you take away?
It sounds to me from their stories that it's a sort of block by block, brick by brick kind of a mission, that we we're used to these big corporations swooping in and hiring thousands of people. And the story of tomorrow for Michigan, what Austin found in Detroit, what other people found is that it's small businesses, maybe a little bit bigger businesses, but step by step building their communities, and hopefully that spreads elsewhere.
Just like the Avalon Bakery.
Yeah.
You found that. I'm wondering, Austin, does what you've been doing on this website on reinventing Michigan, what does it make you think about staying in Michigan after you graduate?
Our state is definitely coming back from all the stories that I've read, and even just my findings in Detroit. I feel like there's going to be plenty of opportunity for me. And Michigan in itself just spreading out, more jobs coming up. I believe that we'll be fine, to tell you the truth. The stories in themselves like motivate you and lift you up.
So I think what we were trying to do is sort of provide some stories of hope and look at the future, but also say, here's the reality. Here's where we have to come from. And before you start celebrating and thinking the mission is finished, take these stories into account, but also look at the people who are getting together and trying to make some sunlight come through for the state.
And while it's a terrific opportunity for the rest of us to really see the young view, the college age future leader of Michigan's view of the state.
You know, Cindy, I learned a lot from my students. I think I learn more from them than they learn from me. And
I say that.
Thank you, Austin. But I felt like all the years I've covered Detroit and Michigan, I learned things I didn't know. And that's exactly what we need, are fresh eyes, new writing, new multimedia. And just let's learn some more about our state.
And the website is reinventingmichigan.com, all put together by Mickey Maynard's business journalism students at Central Michigan University. We've been talking with Mickey Maynard and one of her students, Austin Stowe, who is a junior at Central. Thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Yeah, no problem. It was a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Cindy.
So what are your thoughts about the future of Michigan? Are you a college student looking to stay? And what's going on in your city that's really helping to make our state a better place? Let us know what you think. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And on Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Once a Michigander, always a Michigander, even if you've moved away from the Mitten State. That's the idea that underpins a brand new website and social networks called Mitten Stretcher. It's designed to bring Michiganders together, no matter where we may now be living. Mark Serra is the founder of the Mitten Stretcher community and mittenstretcher.com, and he joins us now from Ypsilanti. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Well, you say you wanted to create an outlet for pride. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think that folks from Michigan are a little bit more adamant about where they're from. They're so proud to be from here. And whether you're here in Michigan or, you know, traveling somewhere else, anytime you run into someone from this state, you notice how proud they are to be from here. With the economic downturn and some of the challenges that we've seen and people having to leave for whatever reason, you know, a lot of that had to do with jobs and things. But, you know, I wanted to give people a place to come together and say, hey, there's a lot of great things going on here. I had to leave, but I'm proud to be from here. And let's connect based on that, using that as a common bond to do so, and creating this kind of informed, engaged community.
Give us an idea of what this community looks like. I know you've got the website, you've got mittenstretcher.com, and you have the Mitten Stretcher community.
The community itself would operate like a social network where you can go on and you can create and join groups. You can post things, and then you can follow posts. You can comment on them. You can follow people. It would be like a bare-bones version of something else that you might see through, with, you know, Facebook or Twitter or something.
Okay.
But it's really, it's very niche-y. It's Michigan-based. So the idea is, you know what, I'd live in Arizona, for example. So I can go on here and start an Arizona group and then connect with other, you know, Michiganders in Arizona. It's a process. You know, we've only been launched for 3 weeks at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got some good things in place for the next few months to get out in front of people and, you know, kind of direct them there, let them know what's happening. You know, it's going to be a process, but we feel like creating this informed, engaged Michigan, worldwide Michigan community, you know, could really have a positive impact back here at home. And that's why on the mittenstretcher.com side of this thing, they're connected. I mean, mm-hmm. even the logins work together and everything. But when you're on mittenstretcher.com, you're reading stories of progress and pride and positivity here from Michigan, and even stories of those who have had to move away and who are doing great things in other places around the globe. So,
give me an idea of some of the stories that you found that you already have up on mittenstretcher.com, knowing that, you know, like you say, you've just launched it a few weeks ago, so it's still taking its baby steps. But what kind of stories have you found?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've captured some great things from business. I mean, we've talked to some local breweries. I know the Michigan craft beer movement is very big right now. We've interviewed Shinola, the great story out of Detroit with they make bicycles, watches, and leather goods. And then, I mean, that's just a drop in the bucket
sure.
of things that we have. And then we've also interviewed folks who have had to move away from the state, and we have a section called Mitten Pride Worldwide. And, like, this week, we posted a story of a young man who's a Michigan native who's kind of migrated west, and he's now working for Microsoft. So a really cool story there about a guy who's super proud to be from Michigan and now working out in Seattle. And last week we talked to a guy from Wolverine country who now works for Ohio State University. So that was a pretty interesting story to tell, you know. But, you know, it's all about pride, positivity, progress, you know, and then saying, hey, let's connect based on that. You know, let's start and change some conversations, connect the people. And then we have bigger plans for this thing, too. You know, I think maybe eventually it could be used as a tool, even on the economic development side of things, being able to, you know, reattract some talent back to our state. It's a reminder that the door is always open.
In fact, do you find as you are getting in touch with the Michigan diaspora, if you will, the folks who are elsewhere, is there that idea in many people's minds that they'd like to get back here?
Oh, absolutely. I actually was just having a conversation the other day with a gentleman in Kansas City, and he was telling me, he's like, gosh, I really hope that this is the tool that helps me get back, because, you know, he had some issues finding a job here, and now he's employed in Kansas City. But, yeah, I think that's the common theme, is that a lot of people want to come back, you know, and they're just looking for the right time to do so, whether that be for family or jobs or what have you. But And it's also interesting to see on the other side of that when, you know, people get frustrated sometimes. And they're like, oh, I couldn't find a job or whatever, so I have to leave. And then they may have some sort of negative feeling towards the state right when they leave.
Mm.
And then they move away. And then, boom, they're so proud to be from here again. They're like, it's like a day and night thing. They were frustrated because they had to leave, and they might have had a little bit of animosity towards the good old Mitten, but then, you know, they get somewhere else, and it's Michigan pride all over again.
Boy, it strikes me how social media has just upended the experience of having to move away from home, where once upon a time you relied on mom to maybe send you some clearly outdated copies of your local paper, like the Detroit Free Press or the Detroit News. Or
exactly.
Traverse City Record Eagle, whatever. You're getting it, and you pounce on it because it's a scrap of information from home. So,
absolutely. That's the joy of social media. And I think, you know, what we're trying to do here is say this is a little bit more meaningful. You know, we're not going to hammer you with a bunch of watered-down information and like you might see on Facebook, and granted, I dive into it every day too. But, but you know, you're not going to see that because we're connecting for a purpose. And then we're also here to say, listen, we understand that there's value in real relationships, and we're going to be putting together some plans for the fall to actually create some Michigan-based events outside of Michigan too, and actually connect some people in real life. So we're really excited about that too.
Mark Serra is the founder of the Mitten Stretcher community. You can learn plenty more by going to mittenstretcher.com. That's all one word, mittenstretcher.com. Mark, thank you so much, and keep us posted on how you're doing with the site and with the community.
Cindy, thank you. I appreciate it.
And now we check in on Flint's emergency manager, Ed Kurtz, and find out how things are doing in his city. We have spoken with Kurtz before on Stateside about Flint's finances and the fact that he thinks other cities across Michigan could also be on the brink of serious financial trouble. Well, Ed Kurtz delivered a balanced budget for next year for Flint, but the future might not be as bright. Kurtz says declining property taxes and the loss of grant funding could leave Flint with a $3 million hole in each city budget from 2015 through 2018. Kurtz says a solution could be to raise the city's income tax rate. Otherwise, Flint may have to undergo even deeper cuts to city services, including public safety. Of all the medical diagnoses a physician can make, the diagnosis of ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, is really one of the most devastating. ALS, of course, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And medical researchers are hard at work seeking a cure or at least a way to ease the symptoms of this neurological disease. And the University of Michigan's in the forefront of this research. Researchers are asking the question, can stem cell injections delivered directly into a patient's spine lessen the effects of ALS? Researchers at the U of M Hospital have recently wrapped up phase one of a clinical trial exploring just how these stem cell injections work in patients with a deadly disease, and they've gotten the go-ahead to proceed with phase two. And that got us wondering about the state of the ALS research and of the often controversial issue of stem cell research here in Michigan. So joining me in the studio is the head researcher on this ALS project, Dr. Eva Feldman, who's a professor of neurology, and she's the director of the Alfred Taubman Medical Research Institute. Welcome to the studio. Welcome to Stateside,
Doctor. Well, thank you so much.
Describe for us, if you can, so we just understand what it is you're facing as a neurologist. What are the difficult challenges in treating ALS, let alone finding a cure?
So ALS is a very difficult disorder. It's a progressive neurodegenerative disorder that really has no cure up to this point and really very little treatments. In fact, we can actually do not much more than we could do when Lou Gehrig was diagnosed with ALS, you know, in the 1930s. And the ALS is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. So it's from the time of diagnosis, usually to death, is approximately 3 to 5 years. And what patients experience is this very progressive, painless weakness. So first they frequently have difficulty using their limbs, then they'll have difficulty speaking and swallowing, then eventually breathing. And one of the real conundrums of the disorder also is that most patients retain their ability to think normally. So while they're, you know, thinking and engaging, they're having difficulty communicating, difficulty doing all their activities of daily living.
And as a physician, that just has to be so hard to realize that you don't really have anything in the toolkit that's better than it was nearly a century ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that is one of the reasons that I've been so motivated to work on this disorder and to truly understand what causes ALS and try to fast track new treatments.
At least to, if not a cure, at least to ease the symptoms.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Slow the progression of the disease.
In fact, I think that our goal in our work currently is not necessarily to cure the disorder, mm-hmm. although, of course, we would love to, but if we could find a treatment that would at least stop the relentless progression. Mm-hmm. Because now what we see in our clinics is we'll diagnose someone and 3 months later we'll see loss of function. 3 months after that, even more loss of function, you know, going from a cane to a wheelchair to not even being able to go into a wheelchair.
So what are you doing in the research?
So we're very excited about the work. First, let me tell you a little bit about the stem cell work.
Yes.
And so approximately now 7 years ago, I took a sabbatical to the state of California where they were doing very innovative stem cell research, not in ALS, but in other disorders. And I did a set of experiments looking at the potential use of ALS rats and treating those rats with direct injections of stem cells. And what I found, and I was quite surprised, is that rats lived longer and had much more function. And really, the ALS rat looks very much like a patient with ALS.
So that's the goal. That's what you want to achieve.
So that's the goal. So what we did is we went to the FDA, mm-hmm. and they asked us to do a set of experiments or a set of work using a larger animal, a pig, to show that we could safely inject mm-hmm. stem cells, because it is a fairly aggressive procedure to put stem cells right into the spinal cord. Once we showed that, they gave us approval in January of 2010 to begin putting stem cells into the spinal cord of patients with Lou Gehrig's disease. We've now done 18 surgeries on 15 patients with ALS.
And
we have been able to show that this approach is safe. So first we put stem cells in the low part of the spinal cord. And then in the last part of our phase mm-hmm. one trial, we put stem cells in the upper part of the spinal cord. And the procedure is safe. And in a subset of patients, we believe there may be some salutary effects and that this transplantation of stem cells may be slowing the progression of the disorder.
Enough of a measurable effect that you say, let's proceed.
enough of a measurable effect that we say definitely let's proceed to a phase two trial. And in this phase two trial, what we're going to do is inject many more stem cells than we did in the phase one. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we know these stem cells do is when they enter the spinal cord, they encounter the sick nerve cells that are part of ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. And they do two things. One is they surround the sick nerve cells, attach onto the sick nerve cells, and nurse them back to health. Okay. It's really quite remarkable. And the second thing they do is in the sick spinal cord of a patient with Lou Gehrig's disease, the whole, what I'll say, spinal cord neighborhood has a lot of evidence of inflammation and injury. And they go in and clean it up. So they're like good neighbors. They clean up this bad neighborhood, and they also nurse these sick nerve cells back to health so that no longer is there this progressive loss of function, but the patients actually stabilize. And we have a subset of patients that appear to have stabilized. Importantly, though, not every patient responds, and we're beginning to understand from our phase one experience which patients may be more likely to benefit from this type of therapy.
Now, just so we all get a refresher in biology, stem cells do what? What are they and what do they do?
Okay, so there are multiple different types of stem cells. Let me just explain three types. So one are embryonic stem cells. Mm-hmm. And the way we create embryonic stem cell lines is that an egg and a sperm are donated, mm-hmm. placed into a petri dish, and embryos are formed. Now, most of those embryos are used for implantation in vitro fertilization clinics, but some of those embryos aren't used by donating couples. And those embryos can then be taken, and from those embryos we can form embryonic stem cell lines.
You can actually grow
the cells. We grow the cells, and those cells are what we call totipotent, meaning they could become any cell in the human body. So those are embryonic stem cell lines. And now let me just segue all the way to adult stem cells. Mm-hmm. And adult stem cells are found, all of us have adult stem cells. You have them, I have them. And they are found in specific organs. So let me just tell you, there are brain adult stem cells. They can be harvested or examined, but what they can do is become a brain cell.
Yes.
So they're pluripotent. They can become many types of brain cells, but they can't become just any cell, unlike an embryonic stem cell. So they're determined, you know, they have a determination fate.
Yes.
And then right in the middle are the type of stem cells we're using. You could consider them teenage or adolescent stem cells in many ways. These cells know they want to become some type of cell in the nervous system.
Which is just what you want.
Just what we want. Now, they're not as differentiated. They're not as determined as adult stem cells. So they have a much greater therapeutic potential.
I know it took an intense campaign. We all do. An intense campaign in Michigan in 2008 to get voters to approve Proposal 2, which allowed the embryonic stem cell research. That vote actually was 53% to 47% as I look back.
Right.
Even with the passage of Prop 2, there has been controversy. There were some political obstacles even after. Where do you stand today? What's the political climate regarding stem cell research in Michigan today?
I still think we have some challenges, but with those challenges will come opportunities. Mm-hmm. I think our challenge still is that individuals don't understand stem cell research, don't understand the therapeutic potential and how important it is. Mm-hmm. And so our opportunity, of course, is education. But because of those challenges, when, for example, we announced having our phase two trial, we did get pushback from individuals who felt that we should not proceed to a phase two trial for Lou Gehrig's disease. The state legislature has passed a law approximately a year and a half ago that put some minor new regulations, reporting regulations on us that makes it a little bit more laborious for us to do our work because we meet all the federal reporting regulations. So there still is a lack of general enthusiasm by certain individuals about stem cell research. But I firmly believe if they understood what it was completely, then I think they'd really agree.
I would imagine just getting into the minds of people who say it's just not okay no matter what. The question remains, for example, you talk about the three-day embryos and getting the embryonic progenitor cells as they go down the road a little bit. Then what happens to the embryo?
Well, so I think what's important to understand is that these embryos all come from in vitro fertilization clinics. Okay, so for embryonic stem cell lines. And so what we used to do is those embryos that we didn't use, we would literally put them down the garbage disposal. We would destroy them,
okay,
because they weren't being implanted into the woman. So I always say I'm more pro-life than anyone I know, because I don't want to destroy those embryos. I want from those embryos to create embryonic stem cell lines in order to be able to help individuals who have diseases. I mean, embryonic stem cells have the potential for type 1 diabetes, for, you know, to help with childhood cancers, childhood muscle diseases, adult cancers, Alzheimer's disease. I mean, from an infant to our oldest individual, these cells have great therapeutic potential.
When you look ahead and think of what you're doing at the University of Michigan, what does it mean for the state of Michigan? Where do you think, Dr. Feldman, the state would stand in terms of being a leader in the field of stem cell research and medicine?
Yeah, well, I think we have great potential. And there was a study done by a professor at Wayne State, Alan Goodman, who looked at the stem cell potential climate in Michigan in terms of bringing jobs to Michigan and dollars to Michigan. And he saw that if we would open up stem cell research more broadly in Michigan, there'd be like an extra $51 million a year and over 800 jobs as we, you know, engaged more in stem cell research. So I think economically it's important. I also think we are at the forefront. We are the only institution, along with our collaborators at Emory, doing the type of stem cell transplantation or work we're doing in Alzheimer's disease. And I also think it means a lot to the health of the people in Michigan. If we're allowed to do the research, it's not only economically beneficial for the state, but, you know, we are bringing real therapies for diseases that previously have been untreatable.
When you're working, is your focus, are you lost in the science of the work, or are you cognizant of the politics and the emotions surrounding stem cell research?
What I'm most cognizant of? My patients. So I have worked with ALS patients at the University of Michigan for 25 years and have either directed the clinic or directed research at the clinic for that amount of time. We currently have 200 patients in our clinic, and it's a revolving door. So I go out every month and buy 2 to 3 sympathy cards, which I keep in my desk. And so as I'm in the laboratory, say it's midnight and I'm in the laboratory looking at stem cells or looking at my results, what I'm thinking about, to be honest, is not the general public opinion, but I'm thinking about my patients and the fact that I could serve, and I'm trying to serve as the bridge between the basic research I can do in my laboratory and a bridge over to my clinic where I can bring to them some sort of new therapy. So that's really what I think about.
Dr. Eva Feldman, a professor of neurology. She directs the Alfred Taubman Medical Research Institute at the University of Michigan. Thank you for sharing the research and your thoughts with us today on Stateside.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Let's talk now with another U of M researcher who's taking a closer look at the global attitudes about domestic violence. What she's discovered seems to point to a major shift in the way people all around the world think of domestic violence. Rachel Perotti is a graduate student in sociology at U of M. She's a PhD candidate, and her study was published in the American Sociological Review. Rachel, tell us, what was your study trying to assess, and who was in your study?
So I was looking at attitudes among women primarily in 26 countries around the globe. That's many continents, sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, South and Southeast Asia. And I wanted to see if in general people were becoming more rejecting of domestic violence. And it turns out that they are.
Now, the countries you chose, tell me, why did you choose those? It sounds like it's middle to low-income countries?
That's right, middle to low-income countries, and it was all countries for which the data were available.
All right, so give us a sense of what you found.
Of the 26 countries, women in 23 of those countries were more likely to reject domestic violence in the second survey wave, so in the late 2000s, than they were in the early 2000s.
And what about men?
The trends are the same among men, although I didn't have data from as many countries for men, but the trends are the same.
Well, I saw, as I was kind of looking at some of the links to your work, I thought I saw, and tell me if I'm wrong, that in some countries, men were actually more rejecting of domestic violence than the women were.
That's right.
Give me some ideas of what countries we're talking about and why would that be?
In a majority of the countries, men were more likely to reject domestic violence than women. And I did not go into depth to study why this is the case. But it's an interesting finding that deserves more research for sure.
So give me some examples, Rachel, of the when we say the umbrella of domestic violence. You were focusing on a man beating his wife. That was the perspective. For what typical reasons?
Right. So the survey question asked specifically about whether a man was justified in hitting or beating his wife in a certain scenario. So, for example, if she left the house without telling him or if she neglected the children. And I looked at whether the survey respondents said that none of the reasons provided were adequate justification for wife beating.
And that's where you saw this shift.
Exactly.
What do you think, based on your findings, is behind this shift in attitudes and this growing realization that you don't beat your wife for burning the dinner?
I looked at a few possible explanations. I thought, for example, that growing urbanization might be part of the reason for the shift, or rising educational attainment. But it turns out that those things account for a small portion of the change in attitudes, but not a big portion. I also thought maybe that younger generations, as they replace the older generations in the population, were causing this shift in attitudes. And that actually explains almost none of the change in attitudes.
Okay, which you really would have thought it would have. Okay.
Right, exactly. It seems that people in all generations are becoming more likely to reject domestic violence.
But you don't really have a sense as to why that is?
My hypothesis is that it is the global spread of ideas about violence against women and women's rights that is affecting people worldwide. Hmm. So we're seeing this uniform trend across many countries that are very different in many ways. And really, the most plausible explanation for that kind of uniformity across so many countries is a global cause. Something like this spread of ideas about violence against women.
Perhaps somehow messages are being transmitted in popular media that people are consuming that might be opening their minds.
Exactly. So media is one way. There's a lot of programming by organizations like the United Nations that's trying to spread ideas about women's rights. A lot of foreign assistance does this as well. So people have heard of these messages. I think that's the main takeaway from my research is that people have heard the messages that women deserve to have rights and deserve not to be beaten.
We've been talking with Rachel Perotti, graduate student in sociology at the University of Michigan, a candidate for a PhD. And her study, Looking at Global Attitudes About Domestic Violence, was published in the American Sociological Review. Rachel was kind enough to join us in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.